The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we've got Pete Scott, our resident estate planning attorney. He's visiting us, so we're going to try to finally get to a long estate planning email that we received just a few days ago, back in September 2016. This is the New Year show. This is the first show of 2017. The show's going to play for the first time on January 7th, 2017. So welcome, everybody.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
That was Pete. Jim is frantically reading emails, as he normally does at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
I do want to say, I'm supposed to relay a message to you from a listener.
Oh.
Quote, Chris, you're my favorite part of the show. Tell Jim.
Oh, I didn't get that email.
No, they reached out to me because they were frantic when I mentioned that the show a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago now, was my last show. I was joking, remember, at the beginning of the show. I was just checking to see if you were paying attention. So I pretended for a moment like I was leaving the show. I heard from a couple people, actually, that were alarmed when they first heard that, but it's not true, at least not yet. This is my last show.
Yes, after that comment.
Yeah. So, I'm somebody's favorite. Feels good.
Are they from West Virginia?
They are not. Or I think they would have pointed that out.
Where are they from?
I don't think they said. All I remember is that one line. That's really burned into my mind.
You sure this email didn't come from your mom?
I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah. My mom doesn't think quite that highly of me.
She knows you too well.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So at least I have one fan. I have to stick around for a while.
For that number one fan.
For that number one fan signed Georgette. Okay. She also put a real name on there, but she's obviously a longer-term listener. Gets the whole Georgette thing.
Excellent, excellent.
Speaking of West Virginia, did we get any emails over the last couple of weeks?
We have 5 emails
from West Virginia?
No. Not one from West Virginia. Pete, give me that email I just gave you over there. Okay. I want to see if they have...
That's ironic.
What?
Jim's talking about sharing emails, and it's literally in his office. It's handing back a printed piece of paper.
That's how we do it. This one's from California.
Yeah, I like California, I guess.
But we have a star in California.
Yes.
This one I liked. Mm-hmm. He said, I love your podcast. I will gladly be a West Virginia resident if it helps get my question answered.
Of the list right there.
He is from Kentucky, and he does say...
Well, that's pretty close.
That's what he points out. He says West Virginia is basically an extension of East Kentucky.
I'd agree with that.
You're just so desperate to get a star on West Virginia.
We'll hold out a little more, but reserve that one because we're gonna rely upon that email at some point if we have to fill West Virginia.
And then, of course, we have a Texas one today. And then I have three other emails. Another one from New Jersey. Mm-hmm.
Covered with a star.
Another one from California.
Covered.
And another one from New Jersey. My goodness.
We're just back and forth. We're covering both coasts.
No kidding.
Yeah, New Jersey, California.
Well, there are a lot of people in those two places. So,
but we seem
There's
to
get...
There's
a lot of people in West Virginia, too.
We seem to get a large amount of California and New Jersey emails, though.
Maybe they embrace podcasting.
More. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, we received 5 emails since our last show, not counting the email we're going to answer today, if I can find it. Oh, here it is.
Hopefully you notified this person and they're still living.
Lone Star George is his name. He's mm-hmm. from Texas,
mm-hmm.
and he is fully expecting his answer on this show. So,
good thing. Better get to it pretty quick.
If not, he's going to jump on his horse right up here and put a 6-shooter through us, I think. So,
that seems violent.
Well, that's what Texans do.
That seems judgmental and stereotypical.
You don't think the guy has a horse?
I'd say chances are no. More people have no horse in Texas than have horse.
Okay. But the ones that have horses have multiple horses.
Generally, yes.
I wonder if he's a Cowboys fan. As a Patriots fan, I do worry about the Cowboys.
I would, if I were you. I'd worry about the Chiefs as well.
And the Giants. New England can't beat the Chiefs first.
Chiefs look good.
So anyways, I want to welcome our listeners to 2017. As Chris said, Peter Scott, an estate planning extraordinaire attorney, is with us. He was supposed to be retired today, but thanks to yours truly and probably others, he has pushed that out to April, Pete. Is that it?
That's the target.
April 16th?
Yes, exactly. Well, actually 15th, because I'm taking off on the
16th. Of 2025?
Yeah, right. The issue is I can't say no so far, but especially since you keep putting people over to me.
I just
do this one. Just this one. And there's always one more.
There's always one more. There is someone else I wanted to talk to you about who was going to be just one.
I'm going to be out of town, I'm sure.
I forgot who it was. Darn it.
That's okay. You just keep thinking that way.
No. This was an important one, though. I was going to ask you to help me out on this one.
They're all important.
I know, but I can't remember who this person was. I will think of it in a minute or two.
Take your time.
But I do want to welcome you here, and we are going to answer a long-awaited question from Lone Star George is his name. He's from Texas. I'm going to read his entire email. It's a very long one, and we are going to answer this, Chris, in two phases, if you remember, the Pete phase and the Pete-less phase.
Hopefully we're doing the Pete phase today.
We are doing the Pete phase. That would make sense to do the Pete phase today.
I'm just making sure, though.
Okay. So he has, and you've seen his questions, Pete.
Yep.
There's estate planning issues here, and then there's financial planning issues here. So we're going to address the estate planning issues. But also, I think it would be safe to say, Lone Star George is not a typical case that many of our listeners will find themselves in. He has about $7.5 million or so in assets right now, not counting additional savings and growth and things of that nature. So a lot of his estate planning, and when we talk next time, Chris, on the financial planning part, a lot of it isn't necessarily going to apply to many of our listeners. So your recommendation a few weeks ago, Chris, when we said we were going to answer this email today, was to not only address Lone Star George's questions, but then try to add additional insight on how other listeners could relate to some of the topics we're covering.
I think that would be excellent, because a lot of these issues, even though he happens to have his number is 7 million-ish, a lot of people that have 1 million or 1.5 million are going to face some of these similar circumstances. So it doesn't have to be, I would say someone who has $50,000 probably isn't going to relate a lot to this, but you don't have to have $5, $7, $10, $20 million to have these issues affect you. And this is going to point out things that people should be thinking about for their estate. As Pete points out, it's not really for estate tax reasons, because very few people, including this person are going to have to probably worry much about estate taxes. But the estate planning, your assets going where you want them to go now and after you pass away, that's important for people who've spent their life amassing assets, financial and otherwise. So these are going to be some topics that will help you understand what the ramifications are on putting together some of the documents to control these things.
Exactly. So the only reason I share this is today some listeners might be saying, well, gee, why are these guys talking about this? It doesn't apply to me. Today just happens to be an email question that may not apply to everybody. But we're going to try to teach people, Pete, not only help Lone Star George, but everyone else listening, how they may not have as much money, as Chris said, but they still have a lot of the same needs and concerns.
Well, and part of it really deals with estate tax planning, because that's his current plan. But he, like 99.7% of us, does not have a taxable estate. And so the issues that we're going to be talking about once we get through his tax issue are really more applicable to the 99.7% of us who are not dealing with taxes, but it really goes to what is good, solid planning, and, of course, a cost-benefit ratio with regard to the cost to structure a plan like this versus the benefit, and then that is going to be measured to some extent by the size of the estate, but not entirely by any means.
But I will go out and say, even though right now at about $7.5 million, and he may have more, he only listed, we're only talking about what he gave us in his email.
Right.
He will be subject to estate taxes at some point. I feel his estate will grow faster eventually than the exemption amounts increases, which are only tied to CPI.
Right.
And his estate may be... Oh, wait. My coffee. You can come in. Yeah, come in. Thank
Jim,
you.
We pause for Jim's coffee.
Wow. Thank you.
Are you going to take our order, too? Apparently not.
No.
Nothing.
We're out of luck.
Did you want a coffee as well?
Well, not now. The order's been delivered.
Do you want me to have Andrew go?
No, it's fine. I wouldn't do that to Andrew.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. For those who don't know, Andrew, one of my fine employees, brought me another nice Starbucks coffee. It is a holiday-spiced decaf grande skim milk flat white.
It's about as Starbucksy as you can get. You tout this Keurig machine you have out front.
I don't drink that crap.
I know. That's, we'll give you a barely coffee and a second opinion.
No, I do drink a Keurig every now and then, but I do enjoy my Starbucks, as you all know. Okay, so what I will do is read through Texas George's original email to us, and then there were several emails back and forth where we asked for more clarification. We won't need to read through those. And then we'll jump in again to the estate planning side, because Pete did pick up on a few items that he wants to address. And Lone Star George sent you quite a few documents, Pete. I see you have them printed out in front of you.
I do. Yeah, okay. They were excerpts from his plan.
Okay. So you can reference those. I would assume that's why he's providing them. We can reference those. Just save his
His identity.
His, yes.
Protect his identity. Yes.
Thank you. I don't even know why I tried
identity?
That.
Can you say identity?
Identity.
Oh, okay.
That's an easy
but not
one.
Anonymity?
No, I'm not even going to try that word.
Okay.
Maybe my brain thought it's 2017. I can ace it now. But that word.
Nope.
Yeah, exactly. Ain't going to happen. Okay, I have to dig back through this pile of emails, which I print out. Chris laughs at me. I get an electronic document and I print it onto
and
paper.
He uses his iPad as the paper holder.
Well, I was wondering why he had it there.
You like that? It's like an easel. It works perfect. It holds. That's what I love about this $700 piece of technology. It holds a piece of paper right in front of me perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Well, go ahead and read it. You have 10 minutes.
Okay. This came in Tuesday, September 27th, 2016, but Lone Star George did know we were going to get to it, but that we were going to have to take some time.
He's patient as the state is large, apparently.
He's as patient as the size of Texas. That's right. Yeah. Okay, so he begins, as a 56-year-old Itunian from Texas, I'm curious about the following scenario and wonder if you can offer any insight. My 51-year-old wife, Georgette, and I are the evil one percenters. We earn in the top income tax bracket with a taxable income of about $500,000 a year. We plan to retire in 5 years when I reach age 60. We have built a sizable nest egg with the following assets: $2.2 million in tax-exempt Roth IRAs. $900,000 is mine. $1.3 million is my wife's. $1.8 million in tax-deferred IRAs. $800,000 is mine. $1 million is my wife's. $2 million in liquid taxable accounts. Those folks, if you're listening, would be like a bank account or a brokerage account or something of that nature. And $1.7 million in two fully paid off homes. Note that our annual post-tax budget is $160,000. The rest goes to Uncle Sam and to our savings. So what he's saying there, folks, is he has an extra $160,000 after he earns $500,000, him and his wife combined. They're going to pay taxes and savings, and after that, they still have $160,000. We contribute the maximum to a 401k and to a simple IRA. For those who don't know, I don't mean simple as in basic. Simple stands for Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employers. So the acronym for that is SIMPLE, and we call them simple IRAs. So one of them works for a corporation that offers a 401k. The other works for a company that has to have 100 or fewer employees, because that's where simples fit in. You can't offer a simple if you have more than 100 employees. So someone works for a smaller employer, and they have an account that works like an IRA, but you can put more money in it, and those are called simple IRAs. So he continues in his email, obviously, we are ineligible to contribute to a Roth. And I think you would agree, Chris, when we talk about the financial planning part, they probably are not going to be able to do backdoor either, because they have very large existing IRAs.
Correct. So those of you who have heard about the backdoor Roth contribution technique, in this case, they have existing IRAs, which defeats the benefits of trying to do it that way. So
now, you cannot have Roth simple accounts, but you can have Roth 401ks. When we talk next week about the financial planning part, I'm going to encourage them to petition and get a Roth 401k option going. But we'll talk about that next week. So he continues in his email, we have a well-considered estate plan in place, but no islet, cupert, or grat. And then Pete will talk about what all that means. We half expect the reinstatement of an income limit for Roth conversions in the future. I wouldn't half expect that. I would expect something happening with the ability to do conversions and backdoors. We dread a reduction in the federal estate and gift tax exemption, which is currently $5.45 million per person. I think, Pete, he could stop dreading with the current president and Congress. Do you agree on that? At least temporarily.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's our hope, and that's certainly the representation that's been made. So, yeah, we're resting pretty easy, but that can change with another election, of course.
So he's 4 to 8 years of rest right now. So I wouldn't worry about it, Lone Star George, that the estate tax is going to come back anytime soon. But 4 to 8 years from now, it's always a possibility. Okay, so his email begins. Since we recognize that we are paying the highest taxes of our lifetime right now, and since we would likely produce highly taxable income due to required minimum distributions at 70.5, which could potentially impact the taxation of our Social Security benefits, we are considering the following. And then he has some bullet points here. At age 60, take additional distributions from my IRA to keep us in a 25% marginal tax bracket. Now, remember, folks, he's going to retire at 60, so his big income is gone. And what he's saying is he wants to start taking money out of his retirement accounts. He estimates, Chris, $150,000 a year could come out of those accounts and keep him in the 25% bracket. He wants to take that money and convert it to a Roth IRA. Not bad. He will pay income taxes on some of that money and use it to live on. And when his wife reaches 59 and a half, do the same thing with her IRAs. His plan is to slowly drain the IRAs and convert everything to Roth IRAs so we will have little to no RMDs by age 70 and a half. What other factors should I consider about adopting this strategy? Thanks for your insight. Well, as we went over that, I did send him additional emails that got Pete involved because I had some questions that I wanted answered. So I sent him the following list and then said to myself, I got to get the big gun in here, Peter, because some of these things I think he needs to answer. So I asked him, does he have any type of pension income? And he said, no, I do not have any pensions. I asked him, do you have an annuity that will provide guaranteed income payments? If so, how much? He said he has no annuities, no guaranteed income payments, just a pile of assets. Although he did say he could see an annuity as a possible future investment, he hasn't researched this enough. And then I asked, is it safe to assume you're paying the maximum Social Security taxes right now? And he said, yes, we have been paying the maximum Social Security taxes for quite some time. So they have maxed out their Social Security. Do you have any children? Do you have any children with special needs? Or are your children named as beneficiary on your retirement accounts? And then he wrote to us the following. Children are grown with two young grandchildren, none with special needs. Our beneficiaries are in this order. A spouse, family trust in case spouse disclaims, and then number three, equally among lifetime trusts for our grown children. Our attorney drafted the language for IRA custodians, please see attached. And he did send us that language that Pete has. Then he wrote, as another bullet point, this disclaiming language allows the surviving spouse to decide which assets get placed into our family trust. It's a little fuzzy in my memory, but it's mainly due to the potential for exceeding $5.45 million and the growth of a trust. I have notes that I wrote that say, quote, the surviving spouse will want to work with an attorney to decide what goes into the family trust, as the surviving spouse may elect to disclaim certain assets. Note that the Roth IRAs will have note that the non-Roth IRAs will have income taxes to be paid unless the surviving spouse goes ahead and inherits the IRA, which is recommended, and then delays the taxes owed until the surviving spouse's death. I disagree a little there, Pete. You can't delay to death. I think you picked up on that as well. Yeah. And then I said, can you briefly describe your estate plan? And then he wrote quite a bit, and I think we're out of time, Chris.
About 30 seconds before okay. The music starts, and you got a minute to wrap up.
So when we come back, we're going to jump straight into the estate part because a lot of what he wrote got my creative mind flowing. And I wanted to run it by Pete, and he found some things that this gentleman may want to consider. And then next week, we're going to point out a few of the other things that I just read as far as his conversions go and the ability for a surviving spouse to delay RMDs until her death. That doesn't work that way, and we'll have to talk about that next week.
Perfect. So that music means we're here at the end of the first segment here on the Retirement and IRA Show. When we come back, we're going to hear the number one song, or at least a top song from 1935, which is the year that Social Security was started. This week's song for 1935 features a popular hit from the talent of Cole Porter, and it's a work from the musical Anything Goes, but it is not the song we heard previously from the musical Anything Goes. And this song involves an angel. There's your hint, Jim. So we'll be back right after this short break on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit. Why, it's Gabriel, Gabriel playing, Gabriel, Gabriel saying, will you be ready to go when I blow my horn? Blow, Gabriel, blow.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Gabriel, listening to one of the top songs in 1935. As I mentioned before, written by Cole Porter, that version is performed by the ever-identifiable Ethel Merman. She has a very unique voice. Most people recognize it unless they never listened to anything from the 30s.
Which would be me.
Early 40s. Did you ever see The Poseidon Adventure?
I did.
She was in that.
She was? Which one was she?
She was the large woman who had to swim in the water.
And died.
And passed.
Yes.
Yes.
But she saved someone, if I remember
that
correctly.
That was Ethel Merman, wasn't it?
I don't think that was.
I've seen it, but I don't recall.
Are you sure? I'm pretty sure it is.
That was Ethel Merman?
I'll look it up.
Okay.
Sometimes I remember these.
I remember her. Didn't she save her husband by swimming underwater? She saved the whole. I think she saved everybody.
Yeah.
She used to be a swimmer in high school or something, and yeah, she saved a bunch of people on the Poseidon Adventure.
I'll look it up just to make sure. I don't want to, disseminate incorrect information.
Okay.
So back to our
complicated but exciting.
Well,
so
hold on. The name of the song is
That's right.
Blow, Gabriel, blow.
That would be my guess.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I got so wrapped up with the Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah. And it was an adventure.
I remember going to see that was the dawn of the disaster genre.
Yeah, I think it was.
And then they all came: Earthquake and the Towering Inferno and. Yep. All these disaster movies of the 70s, but it all kicked off with the Poseidon Adventure.
And we watched Airplane this weekend.
Oh, yeah,
which is
okay.
A classic.
Yeah, Airplane. All right. Well, let's get back to this because we've got a lot to go over, obviously. I think, and I wanted to read the entire email, and we're still not done, just to give our listeners an idea of the scope and depth of this situation. And in order for us to answer questions adequately, we need more information in this particular case. And Lone Star George did provide quite a bit to us. And now, Pete, we get into some of the meat and potatoes of why you're here. Because when I was looking through his email, and I thought, there's more here than just should he convert his IRAs to Roths or not. And it's the estate issues.
Right.
With an estate that size and the potential growth. Remember, they're still young. They're only in their 50s. If they live to their 80s or 90s, these estates will be quite large. And even though the estate tax exemption is higher than the value of their estate right now, the estate tax exemption only goes up by CPI, whereas his investments could go up significantly more, and eventually his assets will exceed the estate tax exemption, and there will be an estate tax issue here.
Assuming no change in the law.
Assuming no change in the law, exactly.
But he's got about a $3 million cushion here.
Before
he would hit the estate tax maximum exemption.
Assuming they don't, granted, the Republicans are talking about abolishing the estate tax, quote-unquote permanently abolishing, which makes me laugh. It means gone until the next Congress and president. So he could always be exposed to a risk
10, 20, 30 years from now of the estate tax coming back and taking a good chunk of his assets.
Yeah, and that really brings us to probably the first point, and that is where the estate tax, his presence or non-presence or the amounts, Jim, as you pointed out, is somewhat fleeting. We just don't know where it's going to be. So generally, estates this size and substantially smaller, we're putting in contingent planning for an estate tax, just in case. And he talked a little bit about that in his email, although we'll get to in a minute, the documents don't exactly mirror that.
So let me finish the last part of his email, and then we're going to start answering some of these questions. And if you're listening on iTunes, you might want to go back, listen to his email again. There's a lot of moving parts in this. And the other thing I want to point out to our listeners and to Lone Star George, this is by no means a complete and total analysis of his situation. There is a lot that we're not even going to cover that would apply to him.
And there's a lot of information we don't have either.
Correct. So we're only going by what we have. But we are giving him, I wouldn't say recommendations, we're going to be giving him food for thought to take back and chat with his wife about and chat with his estate team and his financial planner and all that. But I don't want him to think we've entered into any type of planning agreement and that this is an in-depth and thorough review. Would you agree with that, Pete?
I would agree. And we're not in a position with what information we have, nor in relationship with him to give him any legal advice.
Correct. So,
Shelley Winters, my mistake.
Okay, I didn't think it was her. I was going to say Shelley Winters, but I didn't want to embarrass you over the radio, so no, I didn't.
I'm more
mature.
No. I'm more interested in disseminating correct information.
Excellent.
So, yes, I apologize to the Merman family. It was offensive, but no, it was a great show. It was a good role, and
yeah,
I was only 9 at the time, so you know my memory was a little yeah. So anyway, Shelley Winters was played Belle, who does pass away from a heart attack during the show.
Yep.
After swimming, because she was anyway.
She was a swimmer. Yep.
Yep.
Okay, so back to his email. Last year, we executed a revised last will and testament. These are minor wills with surviving spouse as executor. In addition, we each executed a durable power of attorney, HIPAA release, and directive to physicians, and a medical power of attorney. So he got all 5 of his documents that he needed, Pete.
Right.
Okay. Important aspects of our wills are contained in the redacted attachments to this email, and Pete has all of those. He sent us parts of his estate plan for Pete to review. Our wills direct everything to the surviving spouse. Looks like outright up to the marital deduction. Then via trust, where surviving spouse is beneficiary. I am fuzzy here. Please see the attachment. And he sent us a very thorough and well-written attachment, Pete, from his attorney, who explained some of the things that he was doing. Our 2 grown children are contingent beneficiaries. If a spouse predeceases, they receive lifetime descendant trusts. Additional features of our trusts. Distributions are for health, education, support, and maintenance. They have some restrictions if beneficiaries have problems with drugs, alcohol, or gambling. Primary trustee is the surviving spouse. Contingent trustee is Fidelity or Vanguard trust departments. And what he means by that, folks, is a corporate trustee. So a contingent trustee is not a person, it's a corporation. Remember, corporations never die, people do. Trusts have trust protectors. And then he shares with us, Pete, and I think you picked up on this too, and if not, we'll chat about it during a break. Each spouse currently has a whole life insurance policy with a face value of $500,000 and cash value of $170,000 each. We do not currently have any islets, Q-perts, and grats. If our net worth exceeds the federal estate and gift tax exemption, these additional strategies may possibly prove useful. I disagree. I think you should consider an islet. What are your thoughts?
Well, it depends on the purpose of the islet. He's in a non-taxable situation. Generally, we use islets to move life insurance out of the
trust. That's what I was going to do.
Out of their estate. Yeah, and you can, and that's going to give him some additional wiggle room, if you will. What I did was, he didn't mention the life insurance in his litany or list of assets.
That's so, what I mean. It's not listed as part of the $7.5 million.
So that pushes him up to $8.7 million.
Exactly.
So that only gives him a $2
million. $2 million cushion.
Right.
So I thought to buy more space. Anyways, Pete and I are kind of like talking like we do when we go out to eat. We'll get back to explain to him why I thought initially an islet could shave $500,000 from him, $500,000 from his wife. That would be included in a taxable estate because that 7.5 or 7.7 million he told us about doesn't include this. So it's really now up to 8.7 because listener, Texas George or Lone Star George, the value of life insurance is included in your taxable estate for estate taxes, not for income taxes because the money is received income tax free, but not estate tax free. And an islet, which for those listeners who don't know what we mean, now we're kind of talking specifically to Lone Star George, Pete, but an islet stands for Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust. And it is a way to still kind of control, I say kind of because there's some big caveats here, but kind of control the life insurance, Pete, but remove what in this case is $1 million of life insurance from the estate tax part of his estate. And the other thing we don't know about this life insurance, Pete, is it increasing? So is the value going to be $2 million in the future for him and maybe for his wife? So it could be a lot larger. We don't know. I haven't looked at the life insurance.
Well, the life insurance trust, Jim's right, is that it's a very easy way to move $1 million off the table for estate tax purposes. But when we're making, and it's a gift, and it is subject to the gift taxes, although those still apply with regard to the state tax exemption. It's one and the same. But because the cash value of the policy's owner only $170,000, you can move $500,000 out of the estate at a gift cost of $170,000. So that leverage is excellent. And that's usually when we're looking at doing tax planning for an estate, what we're trying to do basically is get the taxable value of that estate down below the exemption.
Now, could you do this? Now we're getting really deep here and away a little from what you want to talk about. But since we're talking about the islet strategy here, could he borrow from that 170 of life insurance and then put the money into the islet so it's even less? And then if this policy is already paid off, start using maybe a crummy provision or something to get the money back in to pay that loan back?
Exactly, and that's what we do very often when the cash value of the policy is larger than the gift that we really want to make. So you can borrow against the policy, put the balance, essentially, put the policy in subject to the debt, and then gift into the islet over the future years is what Jim's talking about, and then use that those additional gifts into the life insurance trust to retire that loan the policy.
It and that way you're saving that 170 cost that you were talking about.
Right.
Okay. All right, so I know a lot of our listeners are listening to that right now and not getting it. Don't worry. This is more of an advanced conversation Pete and I were having. But to our listener, Texas George, I keep calling him
Lone
Texas
Star.
George. He's Lone Star Texas. I mean, he's Texas. He's... Lone Star George.
There you go.
How about just George?
He calls himself Lone Star George.
Okay. You should
practice that at home.
Yeah. You should honor his request.
I'm telling you, the guy has a horse, too.
Well, did
you wouldn't call
you
yourself
asked
Lone
him 14
Star.
14 pages of email questions. You didn't ask him that?
Lone Star, if you're listening, well, you better be listening. This is your answer. Write back to me. Tell me how many horses you have.
We'll see.
So I can let Chris read it. Mm-hmm. Maybe he owns a ranch full of them.
I think he's from Dallas, isn't he?
You saying Dallas people don't have horses?
Well, not in town much, unless you're in a parade.
I don't know. Okay, and I don't know if he's from Dallas. He's from Texas. I said he might be a Dallas fan.
I don't know. I'm just making things up.
Okay, so I didn't mean to go down that little rabbit hole with the islet, Pete, but I thought to myself when I was looking through this, why aren't they using an islet to take $1 million out? Because that 7.7 is really 8.7.
Right, right.
And then I also thought with $170,000 of cash value, just borrow from it, keep that money off to the side, gift it back in. I don't know how many beneficiaries would be there from a crime provision, but at least three from what he wrote, yeah, his two kids and his wife. Yeah. So they can get $14,000. So that's 10, 20, 30, 40, something thousand a year into this. They can get that debt paid off in a few years.
Right.
That was my thought.
Good thought.
Okay. So he does have, he does write, we currently have a family charitable fund that we funded with appreciable assets. Sounds like to me they have a donor advised fund, Pete, mm-hmm, that he set up for a charitable deduction. And that's really, I think, all that we need to talk about. The rest, Chris and I will talk about when we talk in his financial planning arrangement. So why don't you now put into English, Pete, what his estate is intended to do and explain it to our listeners?
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about, let me kind of translate what he's done in terms of the planning. And basically, they're using a will-based plan, so what we refer to as testamentary trusts. And those are trusts that are created in the will. It comes from the name of the will, last will and testament. So that's where we get a testamentary trust. The alternative would be a revocable living trust, which would mirror a lot of the provisions of the will that he currently has. It just means that done properly, the estate would, in its administration, would avoid probate and the administration. It would all end up in the same place. So there's no difference post-death after that. So what he's done is the plan has left everything to his wife outright, subject to reduction up to the amount of the exemption, which is currently $5.45 million. So Texas being a community property state, let's just assume this is all community property, and we're at $8.7 million, so $4.35 million in each name. So at Lone Star's death, let's assume he dies first, then it would follow the terms of his will, and it would push up to the marital exemption into what we call the family trust, which is a trust that's set up to keep it out of the survivor's estate at death, and yet the survivor, his wife in the example we're using, would be a beneficiary. In this case, wife and children are both beneficiaries of that family trust. And so when we move the 4.35 over there, there is nothing going outright to the wife the way the trust is
currently.
Currently.
Unless those assets grow to above that, the current exemption, yeah, the five, which is now $5.45 million roughly.
Right. So they would have to grow above that. So first out of the box, when he explained that there was the ability to disclaim, and let me explain disclaimer because we use that a lot when we're talking about estates that are not subject to the estate tax, but we want to build in that contingency in case Congress changes the rules, brings it down to $1 million, $3.5 million, whatever they may do in the future or following this administration, depending on how it plays out. So what we do is we leave everything to the spouse and then give the spouse the ability to say no thanks, put it over in the family trust. Spouse is still a beneficiary. The family trust still has access to it, could still get the income in principle, but it moves it out of the surviving spouse's estate for estate tax purposes, and then that way we can push that amount out, and then the other half that the spouse has can grow up to whatever the exemption is with no estate tax. So generally speaking, the way he's done it now, or under a disclaimer strategy for the entire estate, we can eliminate up to currently $10.9 million that would be subject to estate tax. So his plan provides for that at the survivor's death, in this case the spouse's death, and everything drops into what he's called lifetime trust for the two children, which is great because I really like those. They're generation-skipping trusts, which means that they're not included in the spouse's estate at her death if she dies second, nor the children's estate. Here's the issue there. It's called the step-up in basis. So there's income tax impacts, which his attorney explained in the cover letter quite well, I thought.
He did. Or she did.
Yeah. I don't know if it's male or female. But the issue now that we really, it's if we don't have an estate tax to deal with, then we're really looking at the income tax impact of that, because if there's no estate tax, then we don't need a lot of this. So generally speaking, in an estate like this, what we might recommend is leaving everything outright to the spouse and then give the spouse the ability to push assets over to the family trust if there's an estate tax issue.
And it doesn't go outright to the trust in his setup. It goes to a marital trust first for her, correct?
Actually, it goes outright to her. There's no marital trust, which is my second point. By going outright to her, let's assume that she remarries following his death, which is pretty common. Those assets then that she owns could be subject, if she predeceases the new spouse, at least in Colorado, the new spouse, regardless of what she may say in her will or her trust, half of those assets would go to the surviving new spouse, thus disinheriting his children. And so by putting it into a marital trust for her benefit, and she can be in control of it and have access to it and get all the income and principal, whatever she needs, but at her death, none of that would be subject to the claim of the new surviving spouse.
So there is no marital trust right now?
That is correct.
Oh, I thought there was. So there's just outright and family trust.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
And so in order to, of course, she could avoid that by entering into a prenuptial or marital agreement, as it's sometimes called, where the new spouse waives their right to make any of those claims. And typically that's the case in second marriages where the kids are grown from prior marriages, but not always. So the marital share, as it's called, not to be confused with marital deduction, but the elective marital share means that, at least in every state except Louisiana, you cannot disinherit your spouse. And so that would be the one recommendation that I'd like for him to consider, for both of them for that matter, so that their children are protected from subsequent marriage. The other thing the marital trust can provide, as opposed to going outright with to her, is that it does provide creditor protection for those assets in the marital trust. So we always say, if you imagine, at least in Colorado, she runs a busload of trial attorneys off the side of the cliff, gets sued, the damages to be awarded, assuming it's her fault, are going to far exceed her insurance coverage. So everything she owns, including what she received as an inheritance from her husband, is exposed to those creditors and could be lost to them.
Why do you think, because he has a very involved estate plan with all the documents he sent, why do you think they would go to all this effort, the attorneys, to create everything, but start by leaving everything outright?
Well, Texas has some very strong creditor protection laws. So in Texas, it may not be an issue. In Colorado, it certainly is. So under Texas law, it's one of those states that really does provide some rather substantial exemptions from creditors for its residents. So that might be an issue. The other is, in combination with that, there may be adequate insurance in place between a basic liability policy and an umbrella policy that the attorneys felt that there was enough protection that they need not worry about that. That would be my guess. I don't really know.
Okay.
So that's a possible explanation. Now, in the beneficiary designation for the retirement account, there is a provision for a disclaimer, which is what I think he was talking about. So it provides that at his death, his wife, Georgette Bluebonnet Texas, as he refers to her, is going to receive the IRA or retirement assets where he uses as beneficiary. She can disclaim, and a disclaim is like, no thank you. And she says, no thanks, I disclaim. Then it goes over to the family trust. And so then that's the disclaimer, but she doesn't get to pick and choose which assets go to the family trust. It would be, she does in a way, but it's all retirement accounts.
So let's back up for our listeners here. Goodness, see, that's what happens when I drink my Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
You're not coughing. What are you drinking there?
I'm drinking the Keurig coffee.
Keurig. Well, apparently.
The no cough.
I think it's the milk. All the frou-frou you put in there.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what I want to explain to people is what a disclaimer is and how it's used. So we've talked about this. Didn't we talk about it on the last show, Chris, or the show before, disclaiming planning on IRAs? We had a question on that.
A while ago.
Yeah. So what happens, folks, is the government gives you 9 months, essentially, from the date of death when you inherit something to say, no, I don't want it. And, you know, people might be sitting there, Pete, saying, who would say no to free money? Some people do, mostly for advanced planning purposes. I assume some people may refuse an inheritance if they couldn't stand the person and they want nothing to do with them. And they say, no, you keep all the money. I don't want it. But for the most part, disclaiming, oh, goodness.
You have a minute still.
Oh. Well, the music just makes me shut up.
Well, we found something.
Yeah, well, good. Wow. We'll have to play that more often.
Found Jim's kryptonite. So why don't you wrap it up and tell us what's coming?
When we come back, we're going to get into a little bit of what disclaiming planning is, and then something Pete found that I guess we could say is should be there but isn't there? Is that a way to put it?
Well, if the disclaimer strategy, we want to use that other than for the retirement account.
Yeah, so we'll something that Lone Star George is going to want to hear Pete say.
Perfect. So when we come back from this break, we're going to hear the number one song from this week in 1977 as we look back 40 years. This week's song was created by the husband-wife duo, formerly known as the Fifth Dimension. So we'll find out what song that is.
Well, I remember the Fifth Dimension.
Well, this came after that.
After that.
So we'll find out after this short break.
Captain and Tennille?
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number one song from 1977 as we look back 40 years. That, of course, is Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. singing You Don't Have to Be a Star. Those two formerly in the Fifth Dimension, not physically, but under the band title. But, yeah, that's a catchy tune. I guess we don't hear that one very often.
Yep.
Some of those songs from back in 77 they play all the time now. That's not one you hear on the radio much. Anyway, back to our Lone Star George estate planning discussion. We left off in the last segment talking about disclaiming, which is where the beneficiary, someone who's inheriting an asset, actually has the right to say no thank you. And that's called disclaiming. And beyond their ability to do that, that can be included or can be a component in some more advanced estate planning strategies, if you will. It's just one more piece of control where you can say yes or no, and depending on the answer to that question of whether you want to inherit those, can determine where those assets end up. And it's, correct me if I'm wrong, Pete, but the main reason for having that kind of strategy in place is not knowing exactly what the tax and other estate situation will be at death. You put the plan in place today, but you have to build in some flexibility to maybe accommodate or change course depending on how new legislation, tax laws, or even the circumstances of someone who's inheriting those assets might change between the date you execute these documents and the date where they actually put into force. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. So what you're doing is really delaying the decision as to where assets go typically as a result of estate tax, and that's into the future. So we're building in options that can accommodate changes in the law that the documents are, when you draft them, you're unaware of them. So the disclaimer, and we've been using those for years when we had so much uncertainty in the estate tax, And it's still viable in terms of not having the uncertainty of what the tax laws will be at the time or the size of the estate. So it gives the, in this case, the spouse the ability to determine what's the best course to minimize or eliminate the estate tax. I want to mention one thing, though, that the way that the disclaimer works by most, and disclaimers are a function of state law. The states say what the parameters are. But for federal estate tax purposes and gift, a disclaimer, once you disclaim, you cannot receive any further benefit from that disclaimed portion, nor can you direct where it goes, with one exception, and that is a spouse. A spouse can disclaim, can't say where it goes at the time of the disclaimer, but can say they disclaim it, as in this case, disclaim to the family trust, and can still benefit from it as a beneficiary. Spouse is the only one that can do that. So when we're looking at, since the disclaimant, in this case, the spouse, can't direct where it goes, the documents need to specify if the spouse disclaims, where do the assets go? In the absence of that, then the spouse, when they disclaim, are treated as though they predeceased the person, the decedent that just died. And in this case, if there were the proper disclaimer, or say right now, rather, if assets were going to the spouse outright, from the under the terms of the will, and she disclaims, it would then go to the family trust, but the family trust says if both spouses are dead, which in this case the husband died through the disclaimer, the wife is treated as though she died, then she doesn't benefit from it. It goes right down to the kids' trust. So if she were had the ability to disclaim anything under the will, then it ends up in the kids and she doesn't benefit. So their tax planning with regard to the non-retirement 9RA assets is frustrated by this. With regard to the IRA assets, the beneficiary designation that the attorney has given him, Lone Star George, says to my wife, and if my wife disclaims, it goes to the family trust. Well, in that case, she disclaims it does go to the family trust because that's the next beneficiary in line. She's a beneficiary of the family trust. She can still benefit of that because she's the spouse. But the kids as beneficiaries of that family trust, if they were to disclaim, and that's not in the scenario, but they would not be able to benefit from that in the family trust. So the spouse is the only one that can disclaim and still get benefit from the disclaimed property. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I'm afraid it's not going to make sense to our listeners. So
it's a little complicated.
So I want to try to put into English for our listeners what the heck is going on here. And in short, folks, we have an estate plan that's trying to deal with the unknowns and the uncertainties of just what the heck is going to be taxable at the estate tax level and what isn't. I think that's what the attorneys are trying to deal with, Pete.
Mm-hmm.
And we have government to thank for this because there's no they play with the tax code all the time, and it makes it difficult to do what you want to do because you never know what's going to happen. So the importance of disclaiming is specifically, listeners, a provision that is utilized by certain people, generally, as this listener put, the evil one percenters, but not even just that. There are times where people with much, 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 much less assets than these listeners would also use disclaiming. But you disclaim because you don't know what the future is going to bring. So it's kind of if this, then that. If that, then this. And it allows you to do a little bit of post-death planning. Would you agree there?
I would, knowing all the facts and the rules to play by at that time.
At that time. But when you're putting these documents together, you don't know what the future is going to bring. And yes, a good estate planning attorney will review your estate plan on a regular basis and change it as the law changes. And we're going to encourage Lone Star George to do exactly that. But you picked up on something in here that may or may not, we're not quite sure because we don't have everything, but I'm going to have you talk about it again. I know you just did, but I want a little more clarity. But also for our other listeners, those who this doesn't apply to and those who may be confused, let's look again. We have two groups of assets here. Assets that are going to pass by right of law. Those are going to be his retirement accounts and his life insurance. Those are going to pass by the beneficiary form. You can do disclaiming planning on those types of assets very easily. In this particular case, the primary beneficiary of this account, of those accounts, I would assume would be the wife. Is that what he's indicating?
Yes.
And the contingent beneficiary. In other words, if the wife predeceases the owner of these... Oh, wait.
No. What in looking at the beneficiary designation that the attorneys have provided for the retirement account, primary beneficiary is the wife.
Yep.
The secondary contingent or the first contingent beneficiary is the family
trust.
And then the third beneficiary, if the wife doesn't survive, is the children's trust.
Right. And that's fine.
Okay.
But what I was, now I lost my train of thought of what I was trying to explain here. I'm trying to bring it down a different level to apply to other people is what I was trying to do. So in this particular case, the wife, when you have a retirement account, there's two types of assets, again, listeners. Retirement account assets that pass by right of law and what is on the beneficiary form, and non-retirement account assets. They're two homes. They have two homes. They're real estate. The $2 million plus that they have in a regular account, not in an IRA. Those assets pass differently. What his estate plan allows for right now is the primary beneficiary is his wife. She has 9 months, and the primary beneficiary, listeners, is the beneficiary or beneficiaries, there can be more than one, that will be first in line to inherit the asset. Only if all primary beneficiaries are predeceased will the contingent beneficiaries get anything. So in this particular case, the primary is the wife. The ability to disclaim a inherited IRA, that isn't something that needs to be written into some fancy-dancy testamentary trust or will. It's just the law of the land. The IRS says, look, when you inherit an IRA, you got 9 months to say if you want it or not. It's as easy as that. If you want it, you don't do anything. It goes right to you. But if you don't want it, you can't receive anything of value. You can't take half the account out and say, I don't want the rest. You can take the year of death required minimum distribution. That's fine. That's perfectly legal. But that's the only thing you can take. Other than that, if you don't want it, you have 9 months to say I don't want it, and there's certain rules you have to follow. You get a hold of the custodian.
And just back up for a minute. They will not have the ability to take the income from the account and disclaim it, because one of the rules is that you cannot disclaim something that you received a benefit
Correct.
From prior to the disclaimer. So the disclaimer has to be made before... Well, without any benefit, the income in your example being pulled out. So they have to disclaim the IRA and any income minimum distribution for that.
But Ed always taught, as Ed being Ed Slott here, listeners, that the year of death required minimum
yes.
distribution can be taken and not ruin a disclaimer.
Exactly.
Okay, that's what
but
I said.
But the beneficiary cannot take a distribution.
No, that's what I said. You can't take anything from it
right.
except for the year of death required minimum distribution.
Okay, good.
So now the way that this attorney has set up Lone Star George's, he has the wife as primary. The first contingent is the family trust.
And the family trust is there if the wife disclaims only. If the wife predeceases, then it's the children.
And then there, the next in line is the children's trust.
Right.
So within 9 months of Lone Star George's passing, the wife has to make a decision. Does she want to inherit the IRAs, or does she want the IRAs to go to the next contingent beneficiary in line, which would be the family trust? And she has 9 months to make that decision. Now, he also wrote in his email to us that the non-Roth IRAs, in other words, the traditional IRAs, will have income taxes paid on them, and the preferred is to have the surviving spouse inherit those outright and not disclaim them. That's what the preferred approach is. But she has the right to say no and pass them to the family trust. The issue is the non-IRA assets. The non-IRA assets are going to go to a trust. And now we get a little bit of problems here, Pete, and I want you to explain this to Lone Star George again. When we have IRA assets, it's very easy to disclaim. Again, it's not anything that requires language. It's just the law. You don't have to inherit an IRA. You can disclaim it as primary. It will go to the first in line contingent. That's straightforward. That's law. That's in the IRC code. It's a disclaim. But when the wife decides whether or not she wants to inherit the houses, the bank accounts, the brokerage account, if she doesn't want to inherit them, the next in line is the family trust again. But now we're going to have problems, you said, because the way the law treats when she disclaims non-IRA assets, it's as if she had died before him.
Correct.
And you said in some of the language you found, this creates a problem. Why don't you explain that to him?
Well, let's back up for 1 minute. And the state law says that if she or anyone else disclaims, they're treated as having predeceased
non-IRA assets, we're talking.
Any assets,
any
period.
Okay, IRA assets.
Even IRA assets. Okay. That's the default, unless the beneficiary designation or the will or trust provides otherwise. So the IRA beneficiary designation does provide otherwise. It says if she disclaims, it goes to the family trust. So that's in there. So any asset that has a beneficiary designation, we have to plan for where do these assets go if she disclaims, and we need to lay that out, which in this case would be the family trust. The retirement account has that language. What's missing is that language in the will. So in the will, at least the portion we have, it could be somewhere else, but we don't have that portion if it is there.
So remember this, Lone Star George. What Pete is explaining to you is his interpretation based on the documents you've given us.
Right.
This language may be somewhere else and you didn't give it to us, but Pete picked up on some language not being there.
Yeah, and that would be if the disclaimer provision is in the trust. So in this case, everything outright to the spouse, and if it, and the way the documents we have, if she disclaims, what it says is that any assets that are under the $5.45 million go to the family trust. But if she's dead, it goes to the kids. Well, in this case, if she's disclaimed, she's treated as dead. So any disclaimer is going to go to the kids' trust. Wife then doesn't get any benefit from the family trust because the family trust doesn't ever get set up at that point. What I'm looking for in the will, it says that if the spouse disclaims, any amount disclaimed goes to the family trust, where she is a beneficiary, and because she's the spouse, she can be a beneficiary of the family trust. That's where the tax planning comes into place. Then at her subsequent death, and only then does it pass to the kids, unless the family trust also disclaims. So basically what you have to do with beneficiary designations or with the will, if you're using a disclaimer strategy, is set up your menu, as I call it, as to what are your choices. Spouse disclaims, where do you want it to go? Well, state that. If that beneficiary, be it the family trust or anyone else, disclaims, where does it go then? So you want to set up these layers of where they go if this, then that, if this, then that, and you black it all down. That was done well with regard to the retirement accounts, and that would be the same beneficiary designations we want to use for any other beneficiary designated accounts or assets. The will needs to have that same language in it to make sure it does, in fact, get to the family trust, if that's what is intended.
And right now, Lone Star George, we don't see that language. It doesn't mean it's not there, but you may just want to make sure. I would imagine that those attorneys put it in there and we just don't have it, because they did the email that he sent us from his attorneys, I thought was very well worded and explained it in real good terms for the benefit of Lone Star George. And all the other documents seem very competent.
Yeah, they are. They're well written.
I think we would be surprised if the correct disclaiming language wasn't in the will.
Right.
So Lone Star George, just look for that language. The thing that confused me, and I want you to cover the rest of this segment and next segment for him, is you did make a big deal over pecuniary bequest and fractional share.
Do you really want to go there? let me just preface it by saying this takes about a week or two in law school to work through to understand, and then some postgraduate continuing education classes to understand it. But let me simplify it if I can. There are two types of formula. And what Jim's talking about, within the will, it says how much goes to the marital share, which in this case is outright to the spouse, or can go to the marital trust. How much goes to the family trust? Because the marital trust or marital share and family trust are traditional estate planning for tax purposes. So what we're going to do, and this predates the portability rules we're under now, and this originally started in a day when the unused exemption of the first to die died with them if they didn't use it. So we always had to move all of the assets of the decedent up to the exemption amount into the family trust to make sure that we were taking advantage of that and not losing it. In today's rules, we don't worry about that because any unused portion of the estate tax exemption can be ported or transferred to the survivor. But these trusts still persist, and we use them too with the disclaimer strategy. But basically, what happens, and it becomes important with retirement accounts. That's where, or any like retirement accounts, installment notes that the gain hasn't been recognized, anything that has gain in it or taxable income that hasn't been recognized during the decedent's life. If a pecuniary formula is used, it will and then that pecuniary portion is funded with one of these assets, then all of that income has to be recognized by the trust.
If I could just explain to our listeners, what is pecuniary? A stated dollar amount. Pecuniary is I give $100,000 to this. I give $2 million to that. I give $50,000 to my favorite radio show host.
Or I give the exemption amount to somebody.
It's a
defined number.
Defined number. And they call it a pecuniary bequest. Why? I have no idea. It's an attorney thing. But that's what they call it.
Right. And then the other is fractional. And so what you do is when you read that language, it says this is a numerator, this is a denominator. That avoids the recognition of the income on retirement accounts and installment notes, things like that. So the fallback provision, but first of all, the pecuniary formula is much easier to administer, which is why it's
now, what does Lone Star George have for directing that money? Is it pecuniary or fractional?
He has pecuniary.
Okay, and therein lies one of the issues.
Well, potentially, because the IRAs are controlled by the beneficiary designation, so the pecuniary formula never even is applied to the IRAs or retirement accounts. So he's okay. If there's an installment note or something like that on which gain hasn't been recognized on a sale of an asset, that might be impacted by it, but that's got to be minimal compared to what the IRAs are holding. So in his case, the IRAs just bypass that whole thing. So he's okay.
So we're talking non-IRA assets now. Back to that.
Because the beneficiary designation controls. So any non-IRA assets, if there's gain, installment notes are primary, which you see, and retirement accounts, but the rest of it won't have any impact using the pecuniary formula.
Okay, so perhaps I'm confusing Lone Star George's case with the case we talked about when you first walked in at the front desk.
Right.
That applies more to that email?
Probably, yeah. I haven't read the email because you took it away from me.
True, I did do that. Okay, so in this particular case, Lone Star George doesn't really fall under the... Okay,
Yeah, it's. I think he's in good shape. Now, if for some reason he didn't have the attorneys hadn't put together the beneficiary designation, it might be a real problem.
Okay. Then what I want to get to is what you shared with me off camera earlier, off mic rather, when we were chatting. I think something that I would want to ask Lone Star George, if he was our client and sitting here, Pete, tell us, Lone Star, what you want this, where you want this money to go and what you want it to do. Because
right.
I'm not quite sure it's going to go where he thinks it's going to go. And I want to go back and revisit that.
Okay.
You said initially it seems to you that he wants the assets left outright to his wife.
No, that's what the document says. I mean, that's pretty clear.
That's what the document says. So I'm assuming that's what he wants.
Well, I would hope so.
Well, okay. That's the first thing, Lone Star. We want to make sure that you understand if you, and this goes both ways. We're not trying to be sexist here. If your wife predeceases you, does she want the assets to go first to you predominantly? Or if you predecease her, do you want the assets to go to her? You know, where do you guys, use guys, as we would say on the East Coast, that's a use guys. You know, hey, use guys. Where do you want your money to go? Do you guys want the money to go at the death of the first spouse? You said, and correct me if I'm wrong, you read these in much more detail than me. The way you interpret it is that initially it will go outright to the surviving spouse, or does it go to the family trust?
The first $5.45 million goes into the family trust.
And that's what you picked up on, that it's quite possible nothing goes to the surviving spouse.
Not outright, but keep in mind the spouse is the benefit, one of the beneficiaries of the family trust, which may or may not be what they want.
And that's what we want to find out.
Right.
Okay. And we'll handle that after this last break.
Okay.
So that music means we are at our final break here of the Retirement and IRA Show. We're going to hear the number one song from 1982. Actually, I take it back. It's not the one number one song, but I'll explain that a little more when we come back. We will hear a song. That's the key.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. And click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That isn't the number one hit from this week in 1982. However, the number one hit is the same number one hit that's been for the past 6 or 7 weeks and will continue to be for several weeks. And that's, believe it or not, Olivia Newton-John and Physical are still holding off great songs like
Journey.
Don't Stop Believing by Journey, which is what we just
heard.
That's
the ending of The Sopranos now, as far as I'm concerned.
It's been renamed. That's how it's known now. It's the ending to The Sopranos.
That was the song at the end of The Sopranos.
I saw it.
Just before that guy came out, looked like he was going to shoot him, and then now you don't know. And with Gandolfini, or whatever his name is, passed away, we'll never see another Sopranos.
You sound sad.
Well, The Sopranos was a good show.
I'm surprised you don't make Chris play Olivia's song every week.
He refuses to.
No, I like that song. The only song I didn't like was the Kim Carnes over and over and over again. Tina took that to mean I don't want to hear any song more than once. That's not true.
He loves Olivia Newton-John.
I love Olivia Newton-John.
Well, Jim's got a crush on her, too.
I do. She's very pretty.
She's not singing like she just took a forearm to the neck. Which is what Kim Carnes sounds like to me. She's got something stuck in her throat. Nothing personal, but It's just not my style. The beautiful tones that come out of Livy Newton-John's mouth, though, that's singing.
Now we're talking singing.
Yeah, now we're talking singing.
Okay.
So go into the final stretch here. Do we
don't we have an update?
We don't.
Do we have an update?
Sure we do.
All right, do an update.
On what?
What's new and help with my Social Security?
Oh, that. Okay. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. This week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, I update everyone on the 2017 Social Security number changes, if you will, the changes to some of the calculations and changes to some of the limits, and the cost of living adjustment that's been the gigantic 0.3% cost of living adjustment that is being implemented for 2017. Not large. I'm being sarcastic, obviously, but it's infinitely larger than the zero that was last year. So we're moving in the right direction, I guess. But I just kind of run down all the things, including the earnings test has changed, maximum taxable earnings has changed, all of those things we talk about a lot on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. What's new,
pussycat? That was the fastest what's new update.
Well, I'm excited to get back to the...
No, you're not excited. I do apologize to listeners. This was... especially if you're a new listener, don't give up on us. The show is actually much more interesting and fun.
You're selling Pete short now.
No, Pete's not short. He's taller than me.
Pete, it's, you know, his topic is not boring. It's complicated. And maybe not applicable to all listeners, but none of our topics are applicable to everyone.
Thanks for coming to my defense.
Sure.
I don't feel so hurt now.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jim. Can you focus? Stop touching your iPad.
That's his paper holder.
Yeah. Trying to look through all this. You sent me emails today, and everybody I'm just trying to look.
Several hours ago. Now is not the time to catch up.
Okay, but I do, again, apologize to our listeners because this was a very deep topic. Lone Star George, we're just giving you things to look for or talk to your estate planners on. I think based on the documents I've reviewed, they're very, very thorough attorneys, and I'm sure some of the things that Pete is asking about have been addressed in other documents that we don't have a copy of. Would you say so, Pete?
I would agree. Just the quality of the work here is very good. I would be very surprised that language does not appear in other portions of the documents that he has not shared with us, which is fine because it tends to be towards the back anyway.
Okay. So one of the things I wanted you to clarify for Lone Star that you see, and maybe I misunderstood you, Pete, but you seemed a little bit concerned that the... if he wanted money to go to his wife, it wasn't going to happen because outright money to the wife. Because as you pointed out, he listed about $7.7 million of assets. They're also each own $500,000 of life insurance. So at the death of one spouse, it's really not 7.7. It's not 8.7 either. It's more like 8.2 because the $500,000 of life insurance that one, the decedent, owns is includable in the decedent's estate for estate tax purposes. When you own life insurance outright, that is included in your taxable estate. Now, if you owned it through an irrevocable life insurance trust, which he freely admits he does not have now, but he would consider an ILIT, when you own, or you don't actually own it when it's in an ILIT, when insurance is owned by an ILIT, it will not be included in the decedent's estate unless the insurance is transferred in and the decedent dies within 3 years of the transfer in, then it would be included in the decedent's estate. I would be a fan of them considering an ILIT, especially if their life insurance has increasing death benefits and is projected to grow far larger than the $500,000 that it is. But that's neither here nor there. Earlier this morning when we were chatting, Pete, you wanted to make sure he knew if you took that 8.2 $1 million that would be available at the death of one spouse. The reason it's not 8.7, folks, again, is only the life insurance of the decedent is in that calculation. They each have $500,000. When you take that 8.2, you just kind of divide that in half, as if half of the assets are owned by one spouse, half by the other, especially because they're in a community property state.
Correct.
Unless some of those assets are specifically not community property, is that
right? So any assets acquired during the term of the marriage with marital assets are community property, and community property is owned 50% by each spouse. There are 9.5 community property states in the United States. Typically, those states settled by the Spanish, with the exception of probably Wisconsin, which is a community property state, but it's a little different than the other community property states. But Texas certainly is a community property. Now, if they bring property into the marriage, that's called separate property, and that would not be subject to the 50-50 division.
What we're getting at, Lone Star, is right now, let's just assume it's 50-50, and at the death of one spouse, that would be what, 3 point what?
Well, if you look at the 8.8 as the total assets, including the life insurance, just split it in half, 4.35.
Okay, so 4.35, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less in either direction.
Right.
The way they have everything written now, all of that is going to go to the family trust.
With the exception of the retirement accounts.
With the exception of the retirement accounts, which are going to go to the spouse outright.
Correct.
On the beneficiary form.
Right.
If that, Lone Star George, is what you want to happen, in other words, your brokerage accounts, your bank accounts, the homes, again, we don't know if these are owned equally between you and your wife under community property rules, or if they're separate assets with different ownerships, but let's just assume, Pete, 50-50. So those assets are going to go to the family trust. The only assets that will go outright to your spouse or to the spouse, in case you predecease your wife or she predeceases you, the only assets that will go to the spouses right now, unless they disclaim, are the retirement accounts, the IRAs and the Roth IRAs. All other assets are going to go into the family trust. If that's the way you want it, perfect. That's exactly the way it is. Would you agree on that?
I would.
If you wanted other non-retirement assets to go to the surviving spouse, not all of them, maybe just some of them, that's not going to happen under this unless they disclaim. No, that wouldn't happen even with the disclaiming. So forget the disclaiming part. Under the current language they have, that won't happen. Is that correct, Pete, or am I getting that wrong?
No, if the assets that would be subject to the provisions of the will, which would be any assets that don't have a beneficiary designation, then, and assuming it's community property, half will go to the family trust, nothing to the surviving spouse under the will.
And where does the other half go?
Well, the other half is owned by
already
the survivor.
Owned by the survivor.
So the surviving spouse will keep that other half.
Right. It's their half of the community property. The nice thing is, too, we kind of glossed over this on the income tax side, because of the nature of community property, other than what we call IRD, which would be essentially the retirement assets, all of the assets, both retained by the survivor and the decedent share, will get an increase in basis to the fair market value at the date of death.
Twice, at both deaths.
But the entire estate gets stepped up. And then
even just when one dies.
Just when the first one dies, yeah. So that's nice. That's a nice benefit in community property states.
So we just want you to understand that these non-retirement assets, some will stay to the spouse because of community property rules. Some will go into the family trust.
Right.
And then the retirement accounts will go outright to the other spouse. There is no trust involved unless a disclaim is done.
Correct.
Since they've written the retirement accounts to have this flexibility of the disclaimer possibility, do you find it strange that that flexibility isn't built into the non-retirement account assets?
Well, he said that maybe in there, it's not in the documents you've seen, the language to give that flexibility.
Right. I would be surprised if it doesn't appear later in the documents we don't have. Yes. To answer your question, Chris, if we didn't have that menu as I described, what happens if the non-retirement assets are disclaimed? If it's not in there, I would be surprised because the quality of this work is quite high.
Okay.
So that's something that I would expect to see there. And we just don't have it. But that's it. I mentioned it earlier, but generally speaking, with estates of this size and even somewhat less or quite a bit less, generally the assets of the first to die are left to the survivor in a trust, marital trust typically, to protect against a remarriage. What the ladies, at least in my practice, call the anti-bimbo provision. And, of course, Bo the tennis pro is the corollary to that. but it's really to protect the assets for the children of that first marriage to make sure they aren't disinherited by virtue of the remarriage of the surviving spouse, and then their assets end up going to the new spouse, and the children of that first marriage then receive nothing. And that happens a lot more often than you might suspect.
People who don't think that that's a possibility for their particular situation, they can't imagine remarrying someone else. I just wouldn't do it. Well, things change.
Well,
life changes.
My mother-in-law was a prime example. She remarried after her first husband died, swore she would never remarry, and she married a wonderful man at age 80, and they had a wonderful time together until she passed away. And he was just a delight and the love of his life and her life. And so, you know, that does happen. And they fortunately entered into a prenuptial agreement, was what you need to do. But that often doesn't happen. And at that point, then, if you don't have a prenuptial agreement on the second marriage, it does expose the assets that are owned by the survivor of that first marriage to the claims from the new spouse. And what happens is the new spouse doesn't do that. But when we see it happen, it's a lot of times the children of the new spouse loses capacity, powers of attorney, or they have the influence to cause the new spouse to sign a new will or new trust or something, and that's where we see it most often.
And you're saying his estate plan for those assets that would stay to the the surviving spouse at the death of the first spouse,
right.
Those assets aren't going to have any of those protections because they go outright to the spouse, not into a marital trust.
Yeah, same thing would be happen if the surviving spouse had an auto accident, got sued. Any number of things could cause those assets to be taken from her in our examples we've been using. Lone Star George dies first. And it disinherits the children. So by putting it into a marital trust or some form of trust, typically marital, we can build in those what we call creditor-predator protections. New spouse can access it. If they need it all, that's fine. But what they don't use is assured of passing then to the kids.
Well, maybe that wasn't done because it's a smaller pot of their overall potential estate, because the estate tax exemption amount does go into the family trust.
Yeah, true. So that may be the reason why, is because very little, if anything. Well, the retirement assets would be going into the ownership of the new spouse, but then those are protected under most state laws, the IRAs anyway, by virtue of state law that it's not available to creditors. At least it's that way in Colorado.
Yeah, Colorado does, but other states like California doesn't. California does not protect their IRAs from creditors.
Okay.
So you have to know what your particular state law is, and I don't know if Texas protects IRAs or not.
I would suspect it's more like Colorado than California.
I don't know. But you do have to recognize that the way this is, the IRAs, when inherited by a spouse, that spouse can then take those IRAs, turn them into their own, name their children as beneficiaries. That's fine. I don't think in a second marriage the spouse could lose those IRA assets to the new spouse because they pass by the beneficiary designation. They're not subject to ERISA rules, and I think a good prenup could protect them.
Well, a good prenup is the only way to protect him because, at least under in Colorado law, the elective shares is called, and the new spouse that survived can elect to take up to 50%, and in that formula to calculate the 50% is included the IRA assets as part of that.
But total. Don't they have to be married for 10 years? Isn't it 5% a year?
5% for every year of marriage, yes.
Right.
Yeah, so it can be us. That's why I say up to 50%.
And we're getting really deep down this rabbit hole now, listeners and Lone Star George. I think overall, Lone Star George, Pete did a very good job pointing out a few issues he saw with the trust, which probably aren't issues. They just are because we don't have the entire documents. But from the documents that Pete looked at, he can tell he's been doing this long enough. The attorneys are very competent. We assume this language is all there. We just wanted you to get a little understanding of some of these issues. And again, I do want to apologize. This is one of the more in-depth analysis we've ever done on an email before. Normally, our show is a lot more lighthearted, and I try to have fun with our listeners and joke a little and joke with Chris. And he, of course, likes to joke with me when I say something wrong, which is very rare.
And we're only through half the email.
Yeah, we haven't even got to the financial planning part. And the financial planning part, Chris and I will handle next week. And there's a lot of information that not only will apply to Lone Star George, but will apply to a lot of our regular listeners as well. Even if you don't have $7, $8 million of assets, a lot of the strategies that Lone Star could incorporate can benefit people of any means and any size. So anyways, a very deep email. This is one of the reasons it took us a long time to try to address the estate planning part is probably the driest, most boring, because I think the issue is, Pete, people just don't get it. It's like you said when I started mentioning pecuniary and non-pecuniary and fractional, and you laughed and said it takes us a week of study in law school plus grad school to get this. We're not going to be able to explain it to people in 5-10 minutes over the radio.
No, not at all. But just it's not something they need to be aware of necessarily, because that really falls into the attorney's realm where they just need to design the trust in a way that it works.
And that's where I want to give Lone Star's attorneys kudos. That email that they sent to him describing some of the tax reasoning or reasons why they did what they did was so well written because it was so basic yet comprehensive.
I
thought they nailed it. They did a really good job getting him to understand in non-technical terms why they did what they did.
Well, what's nice is they were explaining the difference between state tax planning and income tax planning and comparing the 40% estate tax to the 23.8% capital gain maximum tax rate. And that's not a bad trade-off if you can make that. If you need to pay the 23.8 versus 40%, I'll take the 23.8 every time.
And that will probably be going down a lot under the new administration and Congress. But again, as we're probably going to talk about, because I'm sure we'll have you back at some point in 2017, Pete, talking about the new tax laws that have just been passed. I love when they say comprehensive permanent tax simplification. Anything with the word simplification in means they just made it more complex. But also, it's only as permanent until the next Congress or the next election.
Right.
So, goodness, I've been doing this 17 years, and I think there's been at least half a dozen major changes. You've been doing this for, I think, what, 84 years?
Just shy of 84 years.
Yeah. And this is probably the 50th change in your career. Just teasing you there, little Pete. But we look forward to another fun year. I think that's what we want to say, Chris. And we have 5 more emails to answer after Lone Star's next week. And I think Lone Star will spend a good part of the show with his financial planning questions and then jump into emails. We encourage our listeners throughout the country, our iTunians, to know we are available to answer questions. We may not get to them right away. We try, if you haven't been able to tell, to answer them as thoroughly as possible. There's no quick, I'm going to answer this in 2 minutes type thing that we do here. I know, Chris, you've probably heard the show that I talked about, another nationally known financial planner who gave an answer. You recorded a show. You haven't heard the show yet, but you want to opine in on a future show as well. And what's funny, Chris, is Pete's trying to determine if we can play the actual soundbite of this nationally known financial guy and his answer. And based on the email you gave, I think the attorney friend said we can. Is that a safe assumption?
She said that, yes, we have an exception to the copyright laws, she believes, and gave us a case that is pretty close to our situation. But we'll just have to take a closer look at it.
So on a future show, I want to address that as well. So we got some fun things that we want to talk about. This was, I was driving home a few weeks ago listening to a well-known nationally broadcast, quote-unquote, financial guru give, in my opinion, one of the most horrendous answers I've ever heard. And I would like to be able to play that and talk about that on an upcoming show as well. So we've got a lot of fun things for you, Pete. So you cannot retire in April. Well, sorry to tell you that.
I could come back even in retirement as long as I don't have to work.
So, well, I won't pay you. Not that I have yet.
Well, I was hoping you could double my salary.
I gave you a pie.
Yeah, you did.
Excellent. I'll give you two pies.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So, thanks, listeners. I know this was a deep show today. Future shows are going to be back to our old selves, very lighthearted and fun, as we teach you all you need to know about Social Security, taxes, retirement, income planning, and all the fun things on the Retirement and IRA show.
Excellent. When's Pete going to be back with us again?
Next week.
Be a while?
No.
Next month, maybe?
As soon as he can.
Next month.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, everybody have a great week. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show on the Retirement and IRA Show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.